Today's Teisho will be on Case 36. Case 36 is entitled, Chosha Went for a Walk. Main subject, Case 36 in the Pequan Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Chosha went for a walk. Main subject, one day Chosha went for a walk. When he returned to the gate, the head monk said, Osho, where have you been strolling? Chosha said, I have been walking in the hills. The head monk said, where have you been? Chosha said, first I went following the fragrant grasses, and now I have returned in pursuit of the falling blossoms. The head monk said, you are full of the spring. Chosha said, better than the autumn dews falling from the lotus leaves. Secho says, thank you for your answer. Secho's verse, the world without a speck of dust. What man's eyes are not opened? First, following the fragrant grasses, returning in pursuit of falling blossoms, the slender stork perched in the wintry tree, a crazy monkey shrieking on the age-old heights, Chosha's eternal meaning. Ah. Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen on this beautiful spring day. Yes, it's a little cold, but it's beautiful. Spring is beautiful. This is a poem about a Zen master, or this is a koan rather, almost a poem. A koan by a Zen master named Chosha. He went for a walk. When he returned to the gate, the head monk said, Osho. Osho means priest or monk, where have you been? Strolling, Chosha said, I have come from walking in the hills. So this is really a wonderful, wonderful way to do anything, including Zen practice. You know, this week I had the opportunity to help a friend of mine who is 64 years old. 63. He needed somebody to drive him to the eye doctor. I was not teaching that day. So I could do it. I was working at home anyway. And so his eye doctor is in Edison, near my house. So I drove him to the eye doctor. And I drove him home, you know, after they had dilated his pupils. He couldn't drive. So my friend is, you know, really in good shape. He gets a lot of exercise. He is very fit. And he takes good care of himself. He's a vegan, you know, so he's very serious about what he eats. And he has really good health habits. And his wife had to work that day, so she couldn't take him. So what had happened to him was that he was, the week before he had been driving in the car, and he had begun to get, in one of his eyes, begun to get like a bright lights around the edge of his eye. Anyway, at first he said he thought there was a car in the other direction with the lights on, and then he realized there was no other car. It was just out of one side of his eye. There was this brightness. And so it worried him, and some other things happened, and so he went to the eye doctor right away. And it turns out he has retinal detachment, you know. Apparently, after you're like, 55 years old, even after 50, some people can get this process of the retina basically detaching from the eye. So it's not, thanks to modern medicine, it's not the end of his sight. You know, they're going to keep an eye on it. It's a little bit of a problem right now, but it could keep detaching. And if that's true, they have to go into the eye with lasers. And they can actually reattach the retina. But the thing that made it I think my friend was really bothered by this. You know, as you can well understand, he, like many of us, he uses his eyes all the time. You know, he's on his screen much of the time, and he needs to have good eyesight. He felt, he asked the doctor, is it something I'm doing? Is it too much screen time? The doctor said, no, there's nothing you can do. It's not your diet, This just happens to people when they get older. And my friend was so, he wasn't, he's a cool cat, So he wasn't, I could tell he was bugged by it, though, So he wasn't wringing his hands or something. But this is a guy who has a lot of self-control. He lives a very disciplined life. And, he's good at what he does. He's a very nice person. And it's like, I think he felt surprised because he's taken such good care of himself, right? I don't think he felt betrayed, but he definitely wasn't ready for this, He runs like half marathons and things like that, so he thought in a way that he was the last person this kind of thing would happen to. I understood, I think, pretty well what he was going through, because about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, I came back from a hike in Montana. And then I went canoeing or kayaking. Barbara and I went kayaking with a couple who are friends of ours. Lou and Dawn Kirshner are their names. And we had a ball, but when I got home that night, I had like chest pain, And I just thought, well, it's nothing. So the next day, I got up and I went to my doctor. And my doctor did my EKG and he said, you have to go to the hospital right now. And I thought, are you kidding? I have meetings this morning. I didn't feel badly at all. Just I had a little of chest pain. And he said, I'm your doctor or I'm not. If I am your doctor, you're going to the hospital. And actually, he called an ambulance. And the ambulance came. His office is right in Edison 2, next to a very delicious Indian restaurant that I often go to. And the ambulance drove up, and I think they were expecting somebody who was comatose, right? And I said, hi, guys, And I got in the back of the ambulance. And we went to the hospital. We went to JFK. And, but my EKG was like wildly off, and my heart rate was off. So I was in the hospital for 2.5 days, and they did all of these tests. They did, the echocardiogram, stress test to put me on a treadmill. They checked my blood proteins to see if I had a heart attack, And this went on for several days, and I have to say it, I was really floored at first because I thought, how can this be happening to me? Like my friend, I get a lot of exercise. My blood pressure is very low because I do Zazen. I have very low blood pressure. Fortunately, I hadn't had a heart attack. But anyway, at the end of 2.5 days, the heart specialist came in, and he was an Indian guy. And I was meditating on the bed. It was early in the morning. And he said, "Oh, do you meditate?" "Yeah, you know, we talked about meditation." And he said, "You know, did anybody check your electrolytes?" And I said, "I have no idea what are electrolytes, you know." And so they checked my electrolytes were low. So when you sweat a lot, you lose all of the minerals in your body. And I have never, you know, had like supplemental electrolytes or, you know, like Gatorade and things like that. And he said, "You know, your electrolytes can do this. You can actually have a heart, you can almost have like heart attack symptoms, or people actually drop to the ground in marathons and they can't move anymore because they're out of electrolytes." So since then, I've been taking electrolytes. And it's like magic, you know, it's wonderful. But you know, at the time, it really threw me, right? You know, it's like, how can this be happening to me? You know, I have taken such good care of myself. But of course, you know, it could have been a real heart attack. It could have been a real crisis. People take care of themselves. They take meticulous care of themselves. And this still happens to people. You know, it still happens to people. You know, one of my colleagues a few years ago, Kay was her name, she was, again, this kind of person who kept herself in incredibly good shape. She ate well. She did yoga, you know. And she and her husband, Rusty is his name, they went on vacation. And she came back from vacation and she went to the doctor and she said, "Listen, my back is killing me. I must have pulled it water skiing or something." You know, she does stuff like that. And they did a bunch of tests, and the doctor said, "You have 6 months to live." I'm not kidding you. This really happened. Her funeral was in the chapel here on campus. And she had cancer, and it had metastasized. So, you know, I understand what my friend was going through, I think. Because he, you know, I'm you know, in my 60s, and I think to myself, you know, I'll be the last guy standing. You know, I exercise every day, I eat well, you know, I do zazen, I'm sure, you know, there'll be 100 candles on my cake, you know. But you know, that's a fantasy, right? That's a fantasy. It's a very pleasing fantasy to me, you know, but it's still a fantasy. And you know, we just don't know. And, you know, when my niece was about, I don't know, 4 years old, she has a connective tissue disorder. And she had something called a lazy eye. And they had to put an eye patch on her good eye so that her lazy eye would get strong. And I know my brother and his wife, Sherry, went through a lot of, you know, they were really, you know, you want your child to be totally healthy, right? You know, when you have a baby, you want that baby to be so healthy and happy. And, you know, when you discover that there's something wrong, you know, it's so difficult to deal with. I have another friend of mine, he's the chairman of the history department. And we're about the same age, and he was telling me that his grandson has leukemia, right? You know, and the kid's like 4, right? And he said now leukemia is quite a beatable disease, but this is some variety of leukemia that you know. So I'm not trying to bring everybody down, you know. It's just that, you know, life is very precarious. It is. It's so precarious. You know, and we live in a world where we believe in control. You know, we believe in control. You know, and our whole society is built on like rationally planning for the future and controlling everything and making sure that it works out the way we want it, you know. And so, you know, we grow up with this spirit of control. And it is good to live your life consciously instead of carelessly, right? So, you know, I think it's good to be like a good student. If you're going to school, do your best. Study, you know, work hard. But even if we do all those things, you know, we can't necessarily have the outcomes we want. You know, when I was young, I was a child in the 1960s. And in the 70s, in the early 70s, I finished high school and I went to college. And this was a period, like very optimistic period, you know, where people believed in this future that was going to be really great, you know. They actually used to write books on what people were going to do with all the leisure time they had. Really, there were actually professors who were on talk shows, and they'd talk about the coming leisure crisis. That so many people, you know, people would have too much leisure time. They wouldn't know what to do. They'd have like an existential crisis. Right? You know, I know so many people who have two jobs. You know. So it didn't work out that way. You know, this is what everybody thought. That in France, they've lowered the work week to 30 hours, but here in the United States, for many people, it's like 50 hours. So you know, in the 1970s and 60s, people thought in the future it's going to look like this, and you had all these experts. You know, they were all experts in their field: economists and sociologists and people like that. They all, we're going to have a labor crisis, leisure crisis. We're not going to know what to do with ourselves. We'll have so much free time. Now, if you fast forward, 40 years, it's not like that. You know, it's actually not at all like that, is it? You know? And there are many things that were like that. You know, people thought the future would turn out a certain way. If you had asked people who were adults in the 1970s what it would look like now, nobody would have predicted what happened, what has actually happened. Nobody. In 2008 we had a very serious economic collapse. So one of the things that people didn't want to talk about was that very few people saw it coming. You know, I mean, after it happened, many people said they saw it coming, but until it happened, you know, there were very few people predicting this would happen. And I will never forget, this is before your time, but Russia used to be what was called the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union was a communist bloc of countries. And people never expected it to fall apart. And when it fell apart, it absolutely fell apart overnight. It was like in a week, the Soviet Union basically fell apart. So you know, we live in a world that believes in planning. You know, and yet we have been planning for 100 years for a certain kind of world, and the world we're getting doesn't look anything like that. So, you know, again, you know, we have a global warming issue, right? This is on the horizon. Just this week, they said, could be more sea level rise than we thought. Now, nobody predicted this. Nobody. You know, when I was growing up, you know, people wanted to have three cars, you know, and nobody cared about gas mileage because gas was so cheap, you know. So, you know, gas was cheap. You could have a big car, it could guzzle a lot of gas, and the more cars, the better. You know, cars are beautiful, they're fun, you can drive in them. Nobody thought it would heat up the atmosphere. So you know, we live with a kind of, you could almost say, like a fantasy of control. You know, a fantasy. And we need that fantasy in a way. You know, we need this fantasy of control. I myself have I'll be 100 years old. We'll still be sitting in this room doing zazen. You know, and I'll have a 100th birthday, and there'll be candles on my cake, and so on. 100 candles, and I'll blow them right out, you know, no problems. You know, that's a fantasy, right? the reality is much more complicated, right? It's we can't control. There's a lot we can't control. Almost everything. I don't know if you are. This is before many of you were born. Around the time there was a show on TV called The Gary Shandling Show. I loved that show. I used to watch it faithfully. And Gary Shandling was a very favorite comedian of mine. And he died last week at 66. Nobody expected him to die at 66. You know, he did, least of all Gary Shandling. Actually we don't control a lot. And that seems like a terrifying prospect. But it all depends on how you want to live your life. You don't have to live in fear not having control. You could actually really enjoy your life if you don't cling too much to the fantasy of control. So, Zen, I think, teaches people how to live a beautiful life. Not a life we control, but a beautiful life. And I think those are very different things. In the absence of control, the goal is no longer success, so-called. It's a beautiful life. So being present with what's happening, being grateful for what's happening, helping others. All of this makes life a beautiful life. I talked about this earlier, but I was so amazed. One of my friends, I mentioned, is almost a grandmaster in chess. And he never quite made it to grandmaster. And we were talking about Zen, and we were talking about this wonderful Japanese novel called The Master of Go. And forgive me for repeating myself, but I'm still impressed by how well this advice worked. But, the Master of Go is this wonderful... There's a game that was invented in China. And as usual, the Japanese think they invented it. But the Chinese really invented it. It's called Go in Japanese. And it's a board game like chess, but instead of knights and rooks and queens and so on, There are black and white stones, and it's a much more complex game than chess. And you try to take over territory from your opponent. And if you take if the black stone takes a white stone, then you get to keep the white stone. And there are these beautiful wooden bowls that hold the go stones. But anyway, this novel is so wonderful because it's about a young Japanese go master and an old Japanese go master. And the old Japanese go master never plays to win. He plays to have a beautiful game. It's interesting that when he's steeped in Buddhism and Taoism. And his opponent is a very Americanized Japanese person. So he's very modern. He wears a suit. He has a wristwatch. He's very into planning, rational planning. And, he plans, he thinks out his games. He plans ahead his moves. And the old master never does that. He's very spontaneous because he's not trying to win. He's trying to be at one with what's happening. See? Not trying to win. That's trying to determine an outcome. As soon as you start trying to win, you get tense. Have you noticed that? As soon as you try to control things, you tense up immediately. If you want to make yourself tense, tell yourself, I have to succeed at this. I have to be successful. If you're an artist, if you sit down to paint, or say, this has to be brilliant, and you're just going to have the most miserable day, right? So the idea, the old master understood that as soon as you play to win, or you play to control the situation, you spoil everything. you distance yourself from everything around you, and everything becomes an enemy. It becomes your opposition, right? So now everything is a problem that has to be solved, or an enemy that has to be defeated. And you get tenser and tenser. See, this happens in every area. You know, if you, the opposite of that strategy is the old master's strategy of just playing to be whatever's happening. He's going. It's a trivial way to put it, but he's going with the flow. He's going with the Tao as it unfolds. And if we're not worried about success or failure, we can be responsive in a way that we can't be when we're trying to be successful. Because if things aren't going our way, it immediately produces tension and fear, and that clouds our judgment. But if we're not trying to win, if we're just trying to be present and have a beautiful game, see, now we can be responsive. So anyway, this is a contest between the old master and the new master, and basically, it becomes a national event in Japan, and it's covered in all the newspapers, and it's this battle royale between these two masters. And believe, unfortunately, the young master wins the game, but he also kind of loses the game, because he's totally lost the spirit of the game, see. So when we do Zen, you know, we can practice Zen. You know, there are people who actually have ruined Zen. So you know, you may go to another Zen center, and you might run into one of these people. Their world is actually full of such people. You know, they'll say, "How many koans have you answered?" You can, you know, and you might say, "Well, you know, how many have you answered?" And I've answered 120, right? And you might think, "Oh my God, I've only answered 4, right?" Well, you know, actually, Zen is not about racking up koans. You might only have answered one, and you might be deeply awake. The purpose of answering koans is not to rack up koans. The purpose of answering koans is to wake up. So one would be good enough, you know. Usually one is not good enough for most of us. We have to keep practicing. But one, if one could do the job, that would be all we would need. So it's possible to turn Zen practice even into a kind of a sport or competition. So who can sit the longest, right? Who can sit the longest? You know, that becomes, in some Zen communities, that really becomes like, an issue. And that really ruins the whole thing, you know. I mean, Zen is about the beautiful game. It's about letting go and trusting the process. Trusting the process. You know, we come to sit and we want a certain outcome. Maybe you can get into deep samadhi sometimes, and it's very sweet. You know, when you sit down. The other night, I came up to somebody who was sitting on Wednesday night, and I said, "How was your sit?" And she said, "Oh, it was wonderful. I really got there." And you know, that's wonderful. To get into deep samadhi is so great, and it's blissful and all that. But sometimes that doesn't happen, you know, and you can be bitterly disappointed. But Zen is not really about getting into samadhi either. You know, it's about, you know, we speak in Zen of a nowhere dwelling mind. You know, there's a million different states of consciousness. I don't know if there's really a million, but there's many of them. There are actually many samadhis. You know, when we say we're entering samadhi, or somebody will say, "I've been in samadhi, that was a great sit," they really mean I was in the samadhi of mushin. I was in a deep, empty mind state. But there's actually many different samadhis, and there's many different states of consciousness. And if you get attached to any one of them, you will not be responsive and alert and present with the others. So it's very important in Zen practice not to actually cling to any state of mind. You know, sometimes, you know, there was a very famous story about a Zen teacher whose own teacher had died. And, you know, when he went to pay respects to his dead teacher, he started sobbing. And one of his students said, "Hey, I thought you were a Zen master. You know, you're not supposed to, you know, you're not, I thought you were above crying like that." And the master said, "Listen, when I want to cry, I'm going to cry." See, now that's such a mature attitude. He's not afraid of being sad. See, he's not afraid. He's one with, you know, if your father dies or your mother dies or your beloved teacher dies, it's okay to cry. What are you afraid of? You know, what are you afraid of? Well, you know, afraid of letting go, afraid of losing control, afraid of not being enlightened. You know, all of these things might enter a person's mind. But, you know, that shows a lack of trust in the mind. You know, if you feel sad, it's okay to be sad. You know, great Zen teachers have been sad, you know, actually. You know, even the Buddha was sad sometimes, you know. The Buddha's whole tribe, his whole clan were wiped out in a genocide. I'm sure he was sad, you know. The Dalai Lama had something like a quarter of all the Tibetans were murdered. You know, so, you know, he must have had to do a lot of zazen to deal with that. I'm sure he has his moments when he's sad. You know, there's a wonderful book on the reading list that I highly recommend called Bones of the Master. But it's about, the main character is this Chinese Zen master who had to flee during the Cultural Revolution and is finally going back. Even though he's a Han person, his temple was in Mongolia. And at the time, the Red Guards basically smashed their temple up, and his teacher's bones are in this cave, and he wants to retrieve his teacher's bones and give them a proper burial. And when he gets to the ruined temple where he spent his youth, he starts sobbing, right? And that is an awakened person, actually. He's not afraid to be sad. You know, that's okay. You know, even anger has a place. You know, you should definitely not punch somebody if you're mad. And you should probably count to 10, and you should probably not send an angry email. You should probably put it in the draft folder and wait. Let me just say, from experience, very bad. Right? Nevertheless, you know, when people, it's important to see your anger and understand the sources of your anger. And there are, you have a right sometimes, you don't have a right to punch somebody. Buddhism is about nonviolence, but it's really not non-anger. You can, if you feel angry, you can be with your anger and explore the sources of your anger. There's nothing wrong with that. Buddhists misunderstand this. And when you're angry, it doesn't mean you're not a good person. You know, if somebody comes, if you're, you know, waiting for the subway and somebody tramples on your foot, you're going to get mad. And you can say, "Hey, it's okay." You know, you don't have to smile and, you know, you can say, "Hey, quit standing on my foot," you know. You don't have to punch them. If somebody has done you a real wrong, a real injury, you have a right to feel angry. So you sit with you're not afraid of anger. You know, so it's very important to be present with our emotions and not be afraid of our emotions. That, you know, that lack of trust is what gets us into trouble. There's a kind of wisdom to the deeper mind. And sometimes the deeper mind is saying to you, you need to be sad. Sometimes it's saying you need to be really happy, you know, have a great day, you know. Sometimes it's saying, you know, you're frustrated. It's okay to be, anybody who tries anything worth doing is going to be frustrated a lot. So it's this trusting mind. In Zen, we talk so much about the trusting mind. Trust is the deepest relationship you can have with anything, right? I mean, I have been married for almost 40 years, you know, and for, you know, it takes a long time for two people really trust each other. You can love somebody but not trust them. not totally. You know, trust means, you know, you just hurt my feelings, but I know you didn't want to hurt my feelings. You know, that's trust is a more complicated relationship, even than love. But, you know, it's definitely the case that the deepest intimacy is trust. So, you know, many people misunderstand what Zen is about. You know, they think Zen is about discipline. Being, you know, it is important to be disciplined. You know, you have to get up. You had to get up this morning. I'm so proud. So many people got up and came here, you know, like early. And that takes discipline, right? You set that clock for 5:30 or whatever, and you get up, you know. So yes, you do have to be disciplined. But Zen is not, you know, it's not really, this is not the army. It's not the Marines, right? That's not what we're about. We're about cultivating a trusting heart, the trusting mind. You know, and that is so difficult to do. Because you go to the doctor, and the doctor says your retina is detaching. And that is not supposed to happen. You know, that is not supposed to happen to me. You know, or, you know, you go to the doctor and you say, well, how can I, I'm 56 years old, how can I be having a heart attack? Well, lots of 56-year-old people have heart attacks, right? How can this be happening to me? And then, you know, that trust is, you know, can you deal with those issues with trust? And the answer is probably no. That's why we have to do Zen practice. And we develop a bigger capacity to trust, and a greater openness to what is happening in our life, right? You know, whatever is happening, you know, it could be, you could resist it. You know, if you get a health report that you don't like. You know, one of our members got diabetes when he was like 28 or something, right? And they actually think some forms of diabetes may be caused by infections now, right? So what a raw deal, right? I mean, he was a vegan, kept himself in good shape, and he began to feel really terrible, and he went to the doctor, and the doctor said, you have diabetes. And he's not overweight at all. So he did everything right, and he got this raw deal. You know, nobody wants to have to inject themselves with insulin. I can imagine how difficult that is, because, you know that if you don't get your insulin, you're going to die, right? And you have to go through this. You have to face this every day, multiple times a day. You know, my brother had a condition like that, where if he didn't take his medicine, he was going to die. And, you know, so every day you have to sit down and say, I could die right now, you know. And that could be a terrible situation, or it could make you a really wonderful, open person. When I was in high school, one of the nicest people I knew was a woman whose name was Kay. And I won't tell you her last name, but she was, you know, she was just a top student, very kind, lovely person, and she had like a hole in her heart, right? And by the way, she died like when she was 48 or something she got like pneumonia and died, killed her, right? Because she had like this defective heart valve at a time when there was nothing they could do about it. You know, and she lived her whole life as this wonderful person, knowing that every time you go to bed, you might not wake up. That's really something. And you know, it's possible to be very depressed and angry, and maybe she went through that, but she developed this trusting mind. And the way to do Zen practice is with a trust. You know, you sit down on the cushion, and you're really opening yourself up. You know, you're saying, whatever is in there, I'm going to be present with it. And, you know, you see your anger, you see your jealousy, you see, you know, whatever. And, you know, you just you can be present with your anger. You can be present with your fear. And after a while, the relationship with your anger or fear or pain, you know, nobody wants to have pain, and nobody plans to come to a sit and have a painful sit, right? One of our fantasies is that, you know, I'm sure I'm over that. I'm going to come to sit and my legs won't hurt for some reason, right? But then your leg hurts, and then maybe some days, mysteriously, it hurts a lot. You know, I don't know why. Some days maybe it's the weather, who knows? Some days it hurts more than others, right? And you can get mad, but if you're just present with your pain and you focus on your breath, you know, you realize in some ways that pain is a great teacher. You know, it cuts through so much crap. It makes us possible to be tender, makes it possible for us to be tender-hearted. You know, sometimes being in a little pain really opens us up. It really makes us more sensitive and awake and actually more kind. You know, so even pain is a great teacher for which we, you know, should truly be grateful. If you could just sit down on the cushion and never have any pain, it's unlikely you would be able to accomplish anything, because you'd just be lost in your habitual mental habits. Whereas a pain is like a sword that just cuts through all of that. It's so hard to be untruthful when you're in pain. So you know, one way to think about life is that you have a goal in mind, and you're going to achieve that goal. You know, so you want to be, you know, point A is where you are now, and in 30 years you can see it. You know, you're Attorney General of the United States, or you're something, right? Whatever. And you can say, I've got to get to that place or my life is valueless. This is how many people think this way. And this is a terrible way to live. You know, the other way to live is to say, one day, Chosha went for a walk. You know, at the end of your life, you know, you could say, at the end of your life, you could say, God damn it, I didn't get to be president. Or I didn't get to be, you know, senior vice president. Or, God, you know, that is such an illusion. That is, you know, if you want to have a miserable death, think that way at the end of your life. All the things you didn't do, right? All the things I could have been, I could have done. Lots of people have that terrible mindset. But, you know, if you think we all here for, the Buddha said that at the end of your life, you look back at your life and it's like the blink of an eye. You know? And that is so true. Now that I'm in my 60s, you know, I realize when I was 12 years old, I wanted to throw myself off a bridge if somebody didn't like me, you know? Do you remember that? You know, if your friends didn't like, you said your shirt looked bad, you wanted to throw yourself in front of a bus or something. You know? You get, after a while, you realize this was all so unimportant. Why wasn't I happier? Why wasn't I more happy? You know, I could have been, but I was too goal-driven. You know, I'm not saying you should quit school. I'm not saying that. But if you want to be a good lawyer or a good doctor or a good artist, you know, if you say, I've got to be Jackson Pollock or I'm nothing, you're going to have a miserable life. You know, if you say, this is the adventure of my life, I have no idea what, it's like getting a box in the mail. I have no idea what's in this box. You know, but just getting the box is so great, right? Just getting the box, just being born, you know, what are the chances? You know, the Buddha said that the chances of being born, the Buddha said, if you are a turtle, this is actually the Buddha really said this. He said, imagine a turtle swimming in the Pacific Ocean, and some farmer has thrown into the ocean a yoke for a horse, right? Or we could make it a life preserver. There's a life preserver that's fallen off a boat and it's floating across the Pacific Ocean, and there's a turtle in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and the turtle surfaces, and just as he surfaces, his head goes through the life preserver. What are the chances of that happening, that this life preserver and that turtle would meet in the middle of the Pacific Ocean? Very low. So the Buddha said the chances of being born as a human being are very, very remote in the whole universe. And yet, you know, it happened, and you're so lucky just to be born a human being. So lucky just to be born. You know, and we set such high standards for existence that we can never measure up. And so this wonderful life just passes us by unappreciated. So, you know, if you want to be Jackson Pollock, you're going to be miserable. But if you want to make your art and follow that journey, it could be wonderful. You know, if you want to be I don't know who is a great lawyer, but if you want to be a great economist, you want to be Paul Krugman, there's only one Paul Krugman. You're going to be pretty unhappy. That job is already taken. But why not be who you are? Be who you are. How wonderful that journey could be. One day, Chosha went for a walk. When he returned to the gate, the head monk said, "Osho, where have you been strolling?" Strolling. Life is just a walk. It's just a walk in the hills, you know, looking at the flowers and the trees. Chosha, yes, it's a challenge too, but all of that's part of the beauty of the walk. Chosha said, "I have been walking in the hills." The head monk said, "Where have you been?" Chosha said, "First, I went following the fragrant grasses, and now I have returned in pursuit of the falling blossoms." The head monk said, "You are full of spring," Chosha said. When it's spring, I'm full of spring. When it's fall, I'm full of fall. When it's winter, I'm full of winter. It's the beautiful life. This is the beautiful life. I'm present with what's happening. That's what he means by better than autumn dews falling on lotus leaves. In other words, if it's spring, trust in spring. If it's winter, trust in winter. And Secho, the editor, actually wrote under this answer, "Thank you for your answer," meaning that is a really good answer. Secho's verse, "The world without a speck of dust." The world is actually without any problems. It is we who imagine that there are problems. "What man's eyes are not opened? First following the fragrant grasses, returning in pursuit of the falling blossoms, the slender stork perched in the wintry tree, a crazy monkey shrieking in the age-old heights, Chosha's eternal meanings."